back because I was going to leave my Nancy shirt. I wanted to share before my teaching. I know many of you pray for my mother, and yesterday I was meeting with my mom, and I told her I was teaching this morning. She asked me what I was teaching on, and I said, I'm going to teach on Numbers chapter 11, which if you want to flip to it, you know. And she said, oh, you teach from the Old Testament? You guys learn what? I said, yeah, we believe in the whole Bible. And she said, well, let's get out some Bibles and let's talk about it.
Wow.
And so we did a little bit of that, and she said she wanted to come here. She said, I can't make it today. She said, tomorrow, meeting today. And but maybe the next time you teach, I'll come up. Okay.
Wow.
And, you know, she's come up to meetings before, and I've come to the point where in my mind it's more about she wants to connect with her son than it is, you know, wanting to be a part of this or a part of Jesus. But keep praying. Who knows? Lord Spirit does things unexpected. All right. So Numbers chapter 11. Let me give a little preamble here. I want to share why I chose it, and then kind of what I see in it. And then I'm going to read it, because I think this is a chapter where having some targets to kind of look at before you read it is helpful. There's an awful lot of the New Testament that refers directly and indirectly to this chapter. So I'm just going to name some of those things, and I'm going to name them not because I'm going to talk about them extensively, but maybe the next time you study that, you might want to come back and look at and remind yourself, what did it mean in Numbers chapter 11, and how much more significant is it because of what Jesus has done? You know, last week, Greg Hoy taught on 1 Peter chapter 1, and it was about encouragement in difficult times. And in this chapter, we're going to see people going through difficult times, and there is no human voice of encouragement. There is divine action, but no human voice is encouraging. And, you know, that there's importance to that, to having people encourage you. Jesus described himself as the bread that came down from heaven that a man may eat and not die. In this chapter, people are literally going to eat supernatural food, and it's going to literally lead to their death. You know, in the past when I've read that, when Jesus said it, I always thought, oh yeah, it's 40 years in the wilderness, and they just kind of died out of old age. But no, it's more than that. We're going to see that in the end of chapter 11 here. That a plague comes out, and it's an acceleration of giving people what they want. And Paul refers to that as the wrath of God. And it literally leads to their death. In Luke chapter 11, Jesus sends out the 70, or in some translations it's the 72. In this chapter, God's going to take the spirit that's on Moses, and he's going to give it to 70 or maybe 72 of the elders, depending on how you read it. Someone asks Jesus, how are we supposed to feed all these thousands of people? Moses is going to ask God, how am I supposed to feed all these thousands of people? Someone says to Jesus, there's this outsider casting out demons in your name. Tell him to stop. You know, he shouldn't be doing that. Joshua's going to tell Moses, some people have the Holy Spirit on them and they're prophesying in the camp. Tell them to stop. It's these parallels are so strong. The gift of the Holy Spirit is given. The role of elders is talked about. And the wrath of God is described the way that Paul describes it, as giving people over to what they want, removing the protection, so to speak. So with all that in mind, that's where I started from, why I picked this. I was reading it, and I was just like, wow. Just all these other things were coming to mind. Now, as I've been reflecting on it for a while, I see this chapter like one of those what's the word, where you see art where if you look at it from one perspective, you see one thing, and the other perspective, you see it something different. The optical illusions, right? There's like a famous one where there's two faces and they're facing each other, but if you look at the space between the faces, it looks like a wine goblet, and depending on where you're focused. So this chapter is that in words. There's going to be three major complaints in this chapter. So from one perspective, that can dominate what you see is just the complaints. Equally and opposite, there's three major acts of supernatural miracles from God, which could also dominate what you're seeing. They're both present. They're both there. As we read it, one may strike you more than the other, depending on what's going on in your life right now. And take notice of that. All right, enough preamble. Let's actually read this chapter and talk about it a little bit. This is Numbers chapter 11. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord. And when he heard them, his anger was aroused. Then fire from the Lord burned among them and consumed some on the outskirts of the camp. When the people cried out to Moses, he prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So that place was called the place of burning, because fire from the Lord had burned among them. The rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing and said, "If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and of course the garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything except this manna." The manna was like coriander seed and looked like resin. The people went around gathering it and ground it in a handmill or crushed it in a mortar. They cooked it in a pot or made it into cakes. And it tasted like something made with olive oil. When the dew settled on the camp at night, the manna also came down. Moses heard the people of every family wailing, each at the entrance to his tent. The Lord became exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled. He asked the Lord, "Why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you that you put the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive these people? Did I give them birth? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant to the land you promised on oath to their forefathers? Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing to me, 'Give us meat to eat.' I cannot carry all these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. If this is how you are going to treat me, put me to death right now, if I have found favor in your eyes. And do not let me face my own ruin." The Lord said to Moses, "Bring me 70 of Israel's elders who are known to you as leaders and officials among the people. Have them come to the tent of meeting that they may stand there with you. I will come down and speak with you there and will take of the spirit that is on you and put the spirit on them. They will help you carry the burden of the people so that you will not have to carry it alone. Tell the people, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow when you will eat meat. The Lord heard you when you wailed, 'If only we had meat to eat. We were better off in Egypt. Now the Lord will give you meat and you will eat it. You will not eat it for just one day or 2 days or 5 or 10 or 20, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wailed before him saying, 'Why did we ever leave Egypt? Oh, it was so good in Egypt.' But Moses said, 'Here I am among 600,000 men on foot, and you say, I will give them meat to eat for a whole month. Would they have enough if flocks and herds were slaughtered for them? Would they have enough if all the fish in the sea were caught for them?' The Lord answered Moses, 'Is the Lord's arm too short? Now you will see whether or not what I say will come true for you.' So Moses went out and told the people what the Lord had said. He brought together 70 of their elders and had them stand around the tent. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke with him. And he took of the Spirit that was on him and put the Spirit on the 70 elders. When the Spirit rested on them, they prophesied, but they did not do so again. However, two men, whose names are God is Beloved and Who is Beloved, had remained in the camp. They were listed among the elders, but did not go out to the tent. Yet the Spirit also rested on them, and they prophesied in the camp. A young man ran and told Moses, "Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp." Joshua, son of Nun, who had been Moses' aide since youth, spoke up and said, "Moses, my lord, stop them." But Moses said, "Are you jealous for my sake? I wish that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his Spirit on all of them." Then Moses and the elders of Israel returned to the camp. Now a wind went out from the Lord and drove quail in from the sea. It brought them down all around the camp, about 3 feet above the ground, as far as a day's walk in any direction. All that day and night and all the next day, the people went out and gathered quail. No one gathered less than 10 homers. Then they spread them out all around the camp. But while the meat was still between their teeth and before it could be consumed, the anger of the Lord burned against the people and he struck them with a severe plague. Therefore, the place was named Graves of Craven because they buried the people who craved other food. All right, so there's a lot going on here. The first two paragraphs are about the complaints of the people. And, you know, it's easy to kind of brush this off, like what's wrong with them. But it's also super easy to relate to them. Because who hasn't gone through a period of their life where they were passionately burning for a better life? Where the food was better, where it was easier, it wasn't so difficult, where we could just have it better. It's very easy to relate to. And notice the chapter begins and ends in very similar places. People craving something, the Lord is responsive to it, but even getting it doesn't help. So it begins and ends with the people having this desire, and it leads to them dying. I forgot what I was going to say. Give me a second. Well, one thing to notice here at the beginning is when they eat. When they have this passionate desire for a better life and are complaining about their hardships, and a fire breaks out among them, they know where to go. They go to Moses, right? This is when they were on Mount Sinai and God came down in fire. They said, "No, we don't want to talk to God directly. Moses, be between us." Foreshadowing a time when Jesus would come between us and God and be an intercessor for us that we could cry out to so that death would not happen, to prevent death, just like their Moses is here. And the people's desire for a better life becomes so dominant a strain in their life that it's actually destructive, because that's what happens. If all you see in your life is how bad it is, how wrong it is, how it should be better, how they have it better than I do, there's something about that that destroys you if that's all you see. And that's really the crux of what's happening here. And then later at the end of the chapter, it's mirrored with quail, where people just go crazy greedy. They finally get us something and they're just out of control with it. And this is the thing that Paul's talking about, that the wrath of God, because it looks like the wrath of God, this burning and plague that happens at the end. It's really an acceleration of people getting what they want because the Lord removes his protection. At the end, each person gets 10 homers. Homer in Hebrew is very similar to the word for donkey. It's believed that it's the amount that a donkey can carry. So I don't know how much a donkey can carry, 200 pounds, 400 pounds, right? But nobody had less than 10 donkey loads. That's a couple of tons. It's crazy. Right? It's like, it's me when I get to the buffet. Right, except this is kind of exaggerated. Okay, so in a way, this chapter is the Seinfeld of the Bible. Do we have any Seinfeld fans here?
Yeah.
So for those of you who know, the premise of Seinfeld and the way it was designed beforehand is that the characters would not develop, would not grow, would not change. So you have all these stories that you would have, and it doesn't really affect them. And that's what's happening here. The people at the end of the chapter are the same as they are at the beginning of the chapter. Okay? And in between are these great miraculous acts of God, which don't seem to have any effect. All right? Okay, so in verse 4, it talks about the rabble with them began to crave other food, or some translations use other words. And a lot of commentaries will say that that's a reference to the mixed multitude that came out of Egypt. That not everyone that came out of Egypt was an Israelite. That some of the native Egyptians saw what was going on and were like, I'm going with them. And now they're like second guessing their decision. Like, you know what? We had some free fish over there. Onions and melons were pretty good. You know, maybe we made a wrong choice. And, you know, I read this and I think it's good for us as believers who have made a choice to start following Jesus to stop and take stock once in a while. Why did we do that? Was that the right decision? Is there a part of me still longing for a life outside of Jesus? Have I lost sight of what it is that he has done? And to remember those things. Then we have this paragraph describing manna, which if you notice at the end of the chapter, there's a paragraph describing quail. It's like they're mirroring each other. And that's one of the things I found fascinating is how the structure of the beginning and end of this chapter are mirror images. And the end is like the beginning. And it's what happens in the middle where the Lord's hand is really at work. And we have to remember that this manna came down with the dew. This is not like what God told Adam, that by the sweat of your brow, you're going to have to work for food. This is not that. It's just there. Go get it. Every day. And we all have things that the Lord provides for us every day that become so easy to lose sight of or so taken for granted or so just part of our regular routine that it becomes easy to forget about. And we have to take a minute and stop and think and remind ourselves. And, you know, I think that's a lot of what Peter was trying to get across in 1 Peter chapter 1, to encourage one another, to remind one another, so that we don't lose sight of that. That's part of the reason why here on Sunday mornings we allow people to have a time to share what the Lord's doing. That it would encourage everybody else, that we would not lose sight, that things wouldn't be taken for granted in our lives like the manna was here, and that the things of the Lord would not become things that we're bored with or just, you know, it's nice, but I'm kind of wishing I had the onions in Egypt kind of thing. Okay? So, supernatural manna. And then you have, starting in verse 10, Moses heard the people of every family wailing, each at the entrance to his tent. At the entrance, not on the inside, meaning they're wailing publicly, which means everybody else is hearing it. And that becomes a contagion, you know, you get a bunch of people complaining and it's loud and it's public, and then it becomes very easy to just join in and say, yeah, you're right, yeah, that is what it's like, yeah. Yeah, why won't God give us meat? Doesn't God love us? And it just becomes easy to just become one of the crowd instead of the one that is a voice standing against that and saying, no, look at what God has given us. Don't lose sight of the abundance. Don't lose sight that we don't even have to work for it in the middle of a desert. And Moses gets overwhelmed, and he has complaints. And his complaints are, how am I supposed to meet the needs of these people? Which is true. He has absolutely no possible way to feed those people. It's impossible. So he knows where to go. And his prayer sounds a lot like complaining. And God doesn't fault him for it. God just says, you're right, it's too much for you. So I'm going to provide me. Not only that, but you're burdened. I don't want you to be burdened. I'm going to provide people to help share your burden. And then we have him telling him to pick out 70 elders. And not only that, but in verse 17 and again later, he says, I'm going to come down, I'm going to speak with you, and I'm going to take the spirit that's on you and put that spirit on them. It's three things there. The spirit is the one that kind of captures the imagination, but stop and think about it. God is going to come down to talk to Moses. And he's going to talk in the presence of those elders. That in and of itself is a great, great miracle. For those of you who have ever had the experience where you felt like God was speaking to you at a particular time and place and saying a particular thing, where you just felt really strongly, this is the voice of the Lord. What a great gift. Isn't it wonderful when that happens?
Yes.
Don't you love it and almost like crave it? That is a great, great miracle, a great, great gift, something not to lose sight of and to hold on to. Okay, in verse 18, tell the people, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow when you will eat meat. This is very unusual. The command is consecrate yourselves, which I don't fully even know what that means. But there's no directions on how to do it. There is no, like, you know, normally it's like, When God's giving commands to consecrate yourself, it's like, okay, don't do any work, meet together, eat this, sacrifice that. Here it just says consecrate yourselves to eat meat. Huh? How do you do that? And I think this is supposed to be the kind of the trigger and the warning that God gave to Cain. When God says, Cain, sin is crouching at your door, but you must master it. It seeks to have you. You're going to get the meat that you've been asking for, but get yourselves ready because it's going to be an enormous temptation. And that is real life that we can all relate to, that sometimes we have desires, and when those desires are met, it can be our undoing and our ruin because we desire a thing that's not good for us. And God, in his infinite mercy, protects us from a lot of those things. But if we persist and demand and trash God's name in the desire to have whatever it is we want, at a certain point, he gives us over to those things. That's described as the wrath of God. And frequently it leads to a place in your life that you would best describe as a grave of craving, like the place that they went to. This section of the Bible, it's a journey. It's a journey from a place they called the place of burning to a place they called the graves of craving. And we all have periods in our life that can best be described that way. But as I was contemplating that, I realized the entire Bible is about the journey. In the three major sections of the Bible, there is the conclusion doesn't happen yet. So you have the Torah, which begins with the beginning and ends with we're about to go into the promised land, but we aren't there yet. It ends before the people get in the promised land. Then you have the rest of the Old Testament, which begins with the people going into the promised land. That doesn't work out so great. And it ends with some other great promise, which is kind of fuzzy, and best summed up in the word Messiah. And for those of us who know Jesus, we know Jesus is that Messiah. But for people who don't know Jesus, they're kind of caught. Some of them say the Messiah is a person. Some of them say the Messiah is an age when there's good things in the world. And then you have the New Testament, which begins with the coming of the Messiah. It ends with a fuzzy future that we haven't yet come to, which we call heaven, right? But we're not there yet. It's about the journey. What's happening on the journey? That's what this book is describing. And that's the life we're living. And that's what we're encouraging one another and sharing with one another what the Lord has done to prevent us from ever going back to this place in Numbers where the things of God would be reduced to things that we're bored with or things that we wish we had something better or are not bigger than the hardships of our life. All right, so what happens? Moses gets 70 of the elders. And God comes down visibly. The visible sign is a cloud. And he talks with Moses. And something happens to the elders that they call prophesying. And it's a visible sign. It's something that everybody can see. It's not 100% clear what that is. I used to think, prophecy was just telling the future, but it's clearly something more than that. It wasn't just people running around telling the future. There was some visible aspect, some joy, something, I don't know, the Old Testament equivalent of speaking in tongues or something along those lines, that it was clear to everyone around them that something special was happening. And God took the spirit that was in Moses. Let's take a minute to think about that. What is the spirit that was in Moses? Was that Moses' own spirit that he was born with? Is that just his good personality and character traits?
No.
It's almost comical that it avoids saying it is God's spirit. Right? It's the spirit that's on Moses is going to go on to these other people. This is something supernatural, something special, something wonderful, that the spirit of God himself would go to people. And it would be a sign, and everybody who saw it could recognize it. I mean, they saw two people in the camp. Wait, they're not supposed to be doing that. They're only supposed to be around the tent here if they're going to do that. Practice your religion elsewhere. And they complain. Moses, make them stop. And Moses man, I wish everybody had that spirit in them. I wish everybody was prophesying. I wish it was in everyone. And, you know, the Spirit of God coming on these 70 elders, whatever it meant, whatever it looked like, whatever happened, it doesn't have an effect on the people. They end the chapter the same place they started at the beginning. And I think so much of the talk and the letters about spiritual gifts and about the coming of the Holy Spirit and what it's supposed to do for us and how we're supposed to use it to build up the body and encourage one another is to prevent this, where the Spirit of God would spread among people and it doesn't really affect the people. That we would stand in encouragement of one another, that we would share what God is doing, that we would keep it foremost in our minds, that we would help one another to keep a hold of the work of Jesus in our lives. And that's what the Spirit of God would look like among us. Something that is flowing and gives life and is bigger and greater than the hardships which can consume us. And, you know, what I loved about Nancy's summary is it's not that the hardships are gone. It's not that these people aren't living in the desert. They're living in the desert. But God is acting, and God is doing things. And there's a spirit of appreciation and gratitude and thankfulness, which is a protection for our souls and our spirits from the hardships and the effects of the hardships. Because if all we see is the hardship and the longing for something better, it leads to death. But if we can see the other side of the picture and focus on the work of God in our lives through the person of Jesus, that is life. And it's not life in the future, it's life now in the midst of the hardship that will continue on to become something greater when that day arrives. And that is why we meet. And that's why we drink the bread, or drink the cup and eat the bread. Please don't drink the bread. and remind ourselves of what Jesus has done. And I encourage you today, when you're participating in this thing that we do together as a body, to remember what Jesus has done for you and to have some gratitude for it in your heart. And maybe you share something with somebody today, too. All right? Thank you. Wonderful.